Our special guest tonight, Greg Braden, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Greg Braden. Greg, you always say that we're in this matrix, but a lot of people aren't aware of it. They don't know how to use it. So what good is just being in it all the time?
Well, I think the answer to that question, George, is what our time in history is all about. And this, I thought we probably wouldn't get in this till the next hour, but we can do it right now. I think this...
This is the next hour, Greg.
Well, the conditions... The conditions that we find ourselves in the world today, George, I think are pushing us to accept the responsibility that comes with knowing what we know and using our technology the way we use it in the world. I heard during our station ID a couple times, there's an interview with you, and you're referencing, and the term was being used, end times. Were the listeners hearing that as well, or was that just on my end?
Just on your end.
Ah, okay. Well, it was... I know you've had a lot of guests on who are talking about this being a very unique time in the history of our world, in the history of our civilization, and what that uniqueness means. It means different things to different people. Are we heading toward a time where things are going to change? Probably. Is that change destined to turn out one certain way? Probably not. And I think rather than looking at it as a time of end times, I think what we're looking at is at the time where we individually and collectively get to find out the level of mastery that we have in this universe. It's like we've had the training wheels on for so long. And as those training wheels come off, we are discovering that this world around us is nothing more and nothing less than a mirror in this divine matrix of what we have created. Consciously or not, I'm not saying everything out there is a conscious creation. I'm saying that to transcend our time in history, to survive what we see on the horizon, we've got to find out that we are not passive observers. And, George, I think it's almost universally, in the last 5 years, I've been on every continent of the earth, not every nation, but every continent. And we've spoken to people from all over the world, sometimes directly, sometimes through translators, and they're all saying the same thing. They all sense that we have a power within us that is untapped. There's a potential.
Well, there's no question about it.
Yeah, and you explore it on this program all the time, and that's the beauty of Coast to Coast as a forum, probably the best in the world to do precisely what we're doing tonight. A big part of that power is our acceptance of the fact, and it is a scientific fact, that we each have the ability to create a quality of feeling in our hearts, not thoughts in our minds. And this is a big disconnect here in the West. That feeling that we have in our hearts is directly affecting the physical stuff our world is made of. It has a direct effect on everything from the individual healing of a body to the collective peace of a planet, to whether or not we have that war or not. In my part of the world, Native American traditions, they know. For example, when they feel the feeling as if rain has already happened, and I give this example in the book, I've seen it happen. They feel the feeling of what it feels like to stand with their feet in the mud of their Pueblo village because there's been so much rain, and they smell the smells of the rain coming off the earthen walls. And within hours, there's a rain cloud over their village. It's maybe not in the surrounding communities, but it's there. Can we prove that scientifically? Probably not. Right now, but what we can say is the correlations are so high that there is an effect. Just like the correlations were so high with the woman's cancerous tumor disappearing when people felt the feeling as if she was already healed, or in the case of the Lebanese-Israeli war, that the terrorist activities dropped to zero and all the violent statistics declined during the window when people were feeling peace. All they were doing was feeling peace.
Well, why do people have to feel the peace? Why doesn't this matrix take over on its own and solve the dilemma?
Well, that's a good question, George. I don't know that I know the answer to that. It may be that what you're asking is the fundamental question of who are we and why are we in this universe? I mean,
it seems to me that our involvement in this, whatever it is, mm-hmm. is critical for its success and for events to occur.
I agree. And if we're to believe the way science is a language, and it's only one language that describes our universe, and it's a relatively recent language. It's only been around for around 400 years. There are other languages that describe who we are, how our universe works, and why we're here, and some of those are over 5,000 years old. They use non-technical terms to do that. My role as a scientist, I was trained as a scientist, and I support the scientific method. And what we know is that science is incomplete. As good as it is, it doesn't have all the answers. On the one hand, on the other hand, some of our most ancient traditions tell us how these things work, but they don't tell us why. Science gives us the mechanism, and the spiritual and indigenous traditions tell us how we use these principles in our lives. If we marry those together, George, that was my question. When the end of the Cold War in the late 1980s, when I left Martin Marietta Aerospace, I was working on a project called the MX missile, the Peacekeeper missile. And I asked myself the question that we came so close to the brink of nuclear war on at least three occasions during the Cold War, closer than any of us would like to
be. And we may be even closer now.
Well, precisely. We're finding ourselves even on a more perilous place. My question was this: what happens if we marry the best science that we know today that tells us how things work with the wisdom that has worked so well, it's lasted 5,000 years and gotten us to this place, that tells us how to apply what science knows in our lives? What if we marry those two things together into a greater wisdom? What does it say to us? And what the texts have always said, and the traditions, the living traditions today, and we've just, we were 39 days in the monasteries, 12 monasteries and two nunneries in Tibet in August of 05. So it's been about a year and a half since we were there.
What is it about those monks in monasteries?
Well, as a scientist, George, I was trained to look in the world around me for the answers to some of our deepest mysteries. My thinking was that we would find the clearest answers in the places that have been least disturbed by Western civilization. And the monasteries of central China and Tibet, of the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt, southern Bolivia, and in the mountains, the Andes of Peru, were good candidates because they've been so some of the most isolated, rugged, magnificent, pristine places left on the earth today. I mean, you got to work to get to these places.
Oh yeah, Shangri-La. Huh?
And when you do, though, this is the value. You can sit down, look at another human. You're not reading a text and speculating on what that translation may be saying, or we're not guessing at what a mural on a temple wall says. We're heart to heart, eye to eye with another human, and either directly through a translator, George, I can look at these people, beautiful people, and say, when you healed that miraculous healing that I just saw, or when you were doing these seemingly miraculous things on the outside, what did you do on the inside? How did you make that happen? How did you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty is, these people have no ego, and to them, they laugh because they just assume everybody knows the world works this way.
It's normal. It's natural for them.
So the first thing they do is they giggle. They love to giggle, you know, and then they'll say, well, if you really want to know, we'll tell you. And I talk about this in the book. This was 1998. It was in the presence of an abbot that we had traveled 6 days out of Lhasa, Tibet, over 17,000 feet above sea level to acclimate, to be in this one monastery. To look at this this very ancient abbot in the eyes in 98. We went back in 95, by the way. He had died, so I'm glad we saw him when we did. I looked at him in the eyes, and through the translator, I asked him the question. I said, when we see your prayers on the outside, when we see you chanting for 14 and 16 hours a day, and we see the bells and the bowls and the gongs and the chimes and the incense on the outside, I said, what are you doing on the inside? And through the translator, he said back to me, he said, you've never seen our prayers because a prayer can't be seen. He said, what you're looking at are the things that we do to create the feeling in our body. And the feeling is the prayer. So the feeling is the prayer, not the words. And then he turned the question on me and he said, how do you do this in your culture? And I began realizing that in our culture, when our most cherished traditions, when the New and the Old Testament were edited in the 4th century, we lost some good material. 45 books were edited, 25 were removed completely, the others were condensed. and rearranged. And now that they're being recovered in the Nag Hammadi Library and in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we find what was lost. And what was lost, George, are the words in a 2,000-year-old text or 2,500-year-old text that tell us what quantum physicists are now discovering, that the power of emotion and feeling is the language that this divine matrix, this field, nature's mind, recognizes. And when we can feel in our hearts the things that we choose to experience in the world, the field will mirror it back to us. We've got to give that field something to work with. So people say to me, Greg, it can't possibly be that simple. I've seen it in the laboratory. The papers are published. We have video footage that we show in our live programs. And I say, why would it be any more difficult? So collectively, now this is interesting. If the field is mirroring what it is we feel, and every day we are bombarded with images of fear and war and disease,
sure.
and a little graph, not only are we afraid, we're told how much to be afraid. If it's an orange or a red or a yellow threat day, we're told how much to fear. Is it possible that what we're seeing in the world today collectively is the mirror of our collective fear?
Well, that's possible too.
And if it is, and it works the way that the experiments show, what would happen if we felt just the opposite? What would happen if we felt differently?
Earlier, you said basically that the matrix doesn't distinguish, I'm paraphrasing you,
sure.
between the good and the evil. It's basically middle of the road. But let me ask you this. I mean, I know just in my own experiments over my lifetime, Greg, that if you create evil thoughts, and by doing so, you're tapping into this matrix,
right.
and send them out, it comes back tenfold to destroy you. You know, if you think, you know, I want Greg Braden to get sick tonight, you'll come back with some horrible flu that'll hit you.
The person that is creating
the creator, exactly.
Right.
Why is that then? If this matrix is supposed to be neutral, that there's, you know, yin and yang, it's, you know, positive, negative, it's the same, it balances. Why is it when somebody attempts evil, it eventually comes back and really gets them?
I think a part of this may be, this is so new, George, we're still exploring the language and semantics maybe coming into it here, and I think we're both essentially saying the same thing. The field, the matrix, is the overall container. It's the stuff that holds the universe together. Within that container, it appears that consciousness is like a sub-program, if you will. And consciousness is the operating system that we're working with. So it is our responsibility as the role of programming what it is that we're experiencing. It's our responsibility to recognize right and wrong and good and evil. And the fact that it comes back, both good and good comes back tenfold as well.
I agree with that. The
good, and we've seen it in the healings. It takes a relatively few number of people to create that kind of healing. Actually, statistics show it's the square root of 1% of a given population. Square root of 1%. I've shared that number in this program before. The square root of 1% of any population is a very small number. So in a city of 1 million people, to create a feeling of peace or an experience of peace, it takes a little over 100 people in a city of 1 million, or on a planet of 6 billion people, the square root of 1% is a little over 8,000 people, and that is the minimum number to kickstart that experience of peace. The more that, obviously, it participates, the greater the effect. But what it's saying in quantum terms and modern experience is essentially the old parable, George, that the power of the mustard seed. It takes a relatively few number of people that understand this language and can hone their feeling. And there's a whole conversation we could have about how scattered, I mean, our feelings in our heart. How often do we really have the ability to hold a focused, coherent emotion in our hearts of something that has already happened, of the healing of our loved ones that's already happened, or the peace in our community? So when these experiences are mirrored back to us, I think it shows us how pure and how quickly we can change what we see happening in our world.
Yet, Greg, not everyone who believes gets healed. You know, let's say someone, here's an example, somebody's got cancer, and you cited the example of a tumor that went away. I believe that, that happens. But then we also have someone who believes, who prays, and their cancer spreads, and they end up dying. Why does that happen?
George, the first thing I'll say is we never have all the information, and I wouldn't claim to know all of the reasons. I mean, there are, if we believe in karma, if we believe in past lives, I mean, all kinds of things may come into play. But I understand your question, and I've seen this happen. I know the man that filmed the tumor disappearing in the medicineless hospital, and I asked him the question. I said, those three practitioners helped that woman to heal. Could she have done it on her own if they weren't there? And he said, you know, in all probability, she could have, but there's something about us humans in that we feel more empowered when we're supported by others that believe as we do. And the flip side of that is if she did not make the changes, and what I didn't say, and I apologize because this is the rest of the story, before those people in those medicineless hospitals undergo those healings, they're trained in life-affirming ways to change their life. They learn new ways to eat, new ways to breathe, new ways to move, all the things we're talking about in our country, diet, exercise, you know, fresh air, nutrition. If those three practitioners had created the effect of that healing in her body and she had chosen to stay with the old lifestyle, it's very possible that that healing would be temporary, just as today. I have friends who've had cancers that have been removed surgically. 6 months later, they come back, and then they say, well, you know, I thought the doctor got it, and they got that one, but because they never changed the belief or the lifestyle that the belief is allowing for, the blueprint in the, what we would call the divine matrix, the stuff where matter originates, that blueprint has never been addressed. And I think for on a small scale, that's the answer we're looking at. On a big scale, on a global scale, we're all looking at the same principle on a very large scale. Are we learning that diversity is our greatest strength and that the cooperation is going to get us further than competition? And I think that is the question that we are answering at this moment in this time in history.
Well, are you convinced that there's an intelligence then in this matrix?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because when you look at the way scientists describe this matrix, George, it except for the language, it sounds a lot like what we would call heaven or the heavens in the ancient traditions.
You stole my question.
Sure.
But you're right.
Where if there's an essence to life that leaves the body at the moment of death, where does that essence go?
Mm-hmm.
The ancients say it's in the heavens. What modern researchers and scientists now believe is that that energetic essence is now part of the collective that is in this divine matrix, in this field, until it becomes individual again. It's the field is believed to be the seat of the soul, the origin of the heavens. It's where we go in between lifetimes, for people that use that terminology.
I'll have you give us some examples when we come back, Greg,
sure,
of people who have been able to use the matrix. I won't use the phrase tap into it because you believe we're already in it. So we'll talk about that and much more. In the next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. By the looks of things, you're calling already. Slow down. There's nobody here to answer them. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, Greg Braden, our special guest. Like I said, next hour, we'll open up all the phone lines for you. I'll give you an opportunity to jump on board as we talk about the divine matrix. And welcome back to Coast. Greg, let's talk a little bit also about, and I want you to give us some examples of how this all works, but what's the science behind this?
Well, the science in terms of the existence of the field or how it works, or both?
Both.
Well, this is the reason I've written the book the way I have, George. The first part of the book tells us the science, some of it's so new it's not even in textbooks yet. The experiments that were done in the late 90s, for example, University of Geneva in Switzerland, Nicholas Gizen, where they were showing where they would take a particle, a quantum particle, split it in half, so that each half was identical to the other. They had essentially twins, And they fired those particles in opposite directions from one another, 7 miles in one direction, 7 miles in the other. So they were 14 miles apart. And this gave them the opportunity to do these experiments that just astounded everyone. What they found was when they would disturb one of those particles on one end of the experiment, the other one, 14 miles away, acted like it was the one that was having the experience, as if they were still connected, even though they weren't. And in some cases, the connection was happening so quickly, it was traveling faster than the speed of light. So they knew that it wasn't one particle signaling another, that somehow they're actually connected, and the term that's used now is entangled. And this is a brilliant man, Dean Radin, now has a new book out, Entangled Minds, where he's talking about this phenomenon of entanglement. And there's another principle that comes in here that I'm sure many of our listeners have heard of a holographic principle. And the holographic principle essentially is the principle that it suggests that when we have a little fragment of something, that little fragment mirrors the whole something. So for example, if we were to take a few years ago back in the 80s, there were these shiny holographic bookmarks. You'd hold them in the light, and the image would look like it was floating above your hand.
All right.
And if anybody has these, you can do an experiment, but you can only do it once because you'll destroy your bookmarks. You can cut that little bookmark into about a bajillion pieces, George, and you can take the smallest one and even cut it in half again. And if it's truly holographic, when you hold it under a magnifier, that little fragment, no matter what shape it is, you'll see the entire image in that shape, because that is the definition of a hologram. The whole is always reproduced in every fragment, no matter how small. And this is important because scientists believe, people like David Bohm and Carl Pribram, believe that our universe is holographic and that we are part of that. And the beauty of a hologram, and this is why it's so powerful in the universe, is because every piece reflects every other piece. When a change is made in one place, that change is mirrored everywhere else. And that is believed to be the reason why those particles separated by 14 miles. The question is, it's a trick question. I ask our live audiences, I say, if they're separated by 14 miles, how did the signal that one particle was being disturbed reach the other one 14 miles away so quickly? How did that signal get there, or did it? And this is the trick. The signal doesn't have to travel. It's already there because it is entangled, and because of the holographic nature, the signal doesn't go anywhere. It's already everywhere all the time. This is why remote viewing works the way it works. When our consciousness moves, the language we use is that our consciousness moves from point A to point B. The truth is, we simply tune our consciousness into that place, but we're not really going anywhere. And this is the power of this principle in our lives. When we can feel the feeling as if peace has happened in a woman's body, and her body mirrors that halfway across the room, and we can see it through the ultrasound, we know that principle works. And this is why, if our listeners are listening, I know people out there, you've got loved ones in the battlefield of Iraq, half a world away, and you say, when I feel my prayer for my loved one, how does my prayer reach them on the other side of the earth? And the answer is, when you create that prayer in your heart, it's already there. You don't have to ship your prayer off anywhere. You can use your energy to feel the feeling as if your loved one is safe, and as if they're already healed, so that the field can mirror that back to you. And that's the power of this field, the way it works. And these are some examples, some of the experiments. We know the field is out there because of the way the experiments are working. And then I shared earlier in the evening, we know that when we have certain kinds of emotions, we're affecting that field through those emotions. So that's what the science is showing us. Anecdotally, we've always heard about indigenous people creating rainstorms over their village, or the miraculous healings, such as the one I described in the Medicineless Hospital, mm-hmm. or a number of people feeling peace in the Middle East. While they were feeling that peace, all that could happen was peace. But the question is, and this is what scientists ask, George, they say, if this is so powerful, why is it that when the experiments stop, all those statistics reverse. When those practitioners in the Middle East stop feeling peace, why did all the statistics reverse and the terrorist activities begin again? And this is the crux of the irony that was left to us in those ancient texts, because what they described is this feeling isn't something that we do every once in a while when we want to change the world. It is something that we become. And we can hold these feelings throughout the day. It's not something that we stop and do for a few minutes in a prayer or meditation, and then we get up and leave, and the prayer or meditation is over. If the abbot in the monastery in Tibet, he said to us, he said, feeling is a prayer. There's no words, no outward expression. A feeling is the prayer. Well, we're feeling in every moment of every day, so we're essentially in prayer. This is a modality of prayer, every moment of every day. And if that's true, we can feel that peace or that healing to some degree when we're driving down the freeway to work or in our office place or, you know, at the family dinner table to the best of our ability. That is our workshop in life, to feel those feelings, even though the world around us may not always support or seem to support what it is that we're feeling.
Well, I was going to say, what are the practical ways then to use this in our day-to-day living?
Well, I know there are many modalities of prayer, and I've done programs on Coast to Coast where we've talked about these before. And what I'd like to say is that every mode of prayer is valid. It works. We all use them. Some prayers are called prayers of supplication, where we feel powerless, and we ask for help. We say, "Dear God, you know, help me out here, Archangel Michael, or whoever it is that's out there." And that's one way of looking at the world. This is another way of looking at the world, knowing that we are part of everything that we see, and because of that, we're part of the solution, and that we don't have to ask for help because we are the help. We may participate, as John Wheeler says. We may communicate with this intelligent field to bring about this outcome of healing or peace or abundance in our lives or whatever it is. The key is, and this is easier said than done. I know it is, because of our conditioning here in the West. The key is to feel the feelings as if our heart's desire or our prayer or what it is that we're choosing to experience has already happened. To feel as if the healing is already there in our loved ones, or if the peace has already happened at the family dinner table in our communities, to give that field. Remember, we're programs within this massive consciousness computer of the universe. So we've got to give that field something to work with. And the irony, and this is where I'll close this, and we can talk about this some more, but if we really think about the universe as a computer, and if we think about what we're doing here, George, we're living in a world that very obviously is experiencing a tremendous amount of hate, of rage and anger. And if we think of ourselves as software, we are literally healing the software from within the same program that created the hate and the anger. We're transcending the anger and the hate while we're still in the anger and the hate. It's analogous to a program rewriting itself from within the program without external intervention or external help, because the program has the intelligence to do that. And it's, I mean, that's just an awesome way to think about what it is that we're experiencing here.
You know, the work you've done, how many years have you worked on this?
This is the result. I actually began working on this, George, when I was still an engineer with Martin Marietta Aerospace. And I did the first presentation in Denver, Colorado in 1986. And since that time, it's taken me 20 years sharing these concepts. And you and I, you know, we're talking about this a little differently than the way we do in the book or the way I might in some,
right,
some audiences, but it's taken me 20 years through audiences all over the world, and many of them through translators, to find a language to share these very profound concepts in a way that's meaningful and hopefully in a neutral language. This isn't about religion, although I can see where religions were built around the power and the wisdom of what we're talking about. But this force was there, the field was there long before religions were ever there, and our ability to communicate with this field has been with us since we arrived roughly around 200,000 years ago. So we've always had the language. Religions came along and wrapped themselves around the power of what it means for us to have direct access to the creative energy of our universe for healing, peace, abundance. And I think that's what this time in history is all about. We're recognizing that we are a family, that cooperation is going to get us a lot further than competition, especially for resources on our planet. And that war, I believe we're outgrowing the habit of using war to solve our differences. And then the question is, will we learn that lesson before this next great war?
I'm not sure if we are outliving it, to tell you the truth. I think there are too many people who just don't get it, Greg.
I think what will happen, I agree with what you're saying, and I can see where you would say that, George. And there are two forms of two perspectives of consciousness that I'm seeing happening right now. And there's an old way of solving problems using military solutions and force, and there is a very powerful global current, and you really see this when you leave North America, of people who have recognized that, while we may not always agree with one another, that cooperation is going to get us a lot further than competition. And both of those things are happening simultaneously. And because of the way this field works, because of the hologram, because of the entanglement, because of the connectedness, I think it's going to be kind of like what we saw at the end of the Cold War. We knew some things were going on. We were using military strength to buy ourselves some time. And on the other hand, there were people that were working from a very different perspective to change things. And we'll never know everything that happened. From working with the military, I know that we never have all the information.
See, I agree with you when you say we're always in it. But I believe when you're in it, there are doorways. And in order for you to take advantage of being in it, you need to learn how to open up the doorway.
Absolutely, George. I'm with you 100%. And we mentioned earlier, you know, many people are looking at the anomalies of what are happening, of what is happening in on our planet, physically, culturally, in terms of civilization. Everyone knows something's up. This isn't business as usual. Something big is on the horizon. Almost universally, the text, the traditions, the prophecies, and I know you've had people on the show talking about mm-hmm. this, they describe some very frightening scenarios, and if you take the time to look closely, they always give an alternative. And for those listeners that have studied the Bible Code, and I know you've talked about that on the program as well, some of the most frightening predictions in a 3,000-year-old map of what is believed to be a map of the quantum possibilities of our future, in the Bible Code, some of those most frightening predictions of global war and Holocaust, and those are the words that are used. Right below those predictions, George, there's a phrase that not many people talk about, and I don't know why. But that phrase asks a question. When it shares those frightening possibilities, the phrase says, "Will you change it? Will you change it?" I get goosebumps just saying that. Will you change it? Implying that somehow the outcome that's so frightening is not set in stone, that somehow it's still malleable, it's still soft, and somehow that we are participating and have input and some choice in terms of how this time in history plays out. And that's why I'm so passionate about sharing this material, because we're part of the answer. It's not out there. We can't wait for other people to figure this out. This is us. It's our time in history. I think history is going to look back at us, at this generation. They're going to say, this is the generation that chose peace because they had to survive. But this is the generation that recognized that the 20th century is all about learning who we are.
What about greed, though? Where does greed fit in here?
Well, greed, I think greed is it's a byproduct of power. And power is a lot of what our time in history is all about. Where do we find our power? And do people that really have, that believe they have power, do they really have power at all? Because, George, ultimately what we're talking about, we talk about a force that connects everything and everyone has access to it. And we already know the language to speak to that force. What the ancients said is that opens the doorway to another force that nothing on this earth can touch. And that those are the words of philosophers and ancient texts. What scientists are showing is that when we tap this power of emotion in our, and we are tapping the emotion in our bodies to speak to the field in a meaningful way, that cancers can disappear. AIDS doesn't make any sense to our bodies. And there are people now that have transcended the AIDS virus, that they were born, there were documented cases of children born with AIDS that no longer have the virus in their bodies. And the question is, what do those children do? Are they taking drugs? Are they eating a mushroom in their refrigerator? Are they wearing a stone, you know, around their neck? And while those things may help, the bottom line is those children are feeling a love and support from their family. They don't know that they're supposed to die from this disease. And in the presence of those kinds of feelings of love, their body changes. And we all have, you know, we've all got stem cells waiting for a command from our hearts to tell those stem cells where to go in our bodies to replace whatever that's been damaged. But we're conditioned to believe that that isn't possible. And all of these things are documented in the open literature. It's truly a miraculous way of looking at life. But what the bottom line is, it empowers us to be more than victims in our lives. And at this time in history, I think that's important. I think it's important for all of us.
You know, I use this every day in my life, Greg, all the time, except I am human. And there are some times I feel as if I've closed the door or I'm not in it anymore. Now, like you say, we're always in it. Sometimes I'm not sure.
Mm. Well, we have to be because, as Max Planck said, physical matter stems from this field.
I guess it's like being invited into a home. You're in this house. There are many rooms there, and it's up to you to decide where you're going to go.
You could think of it that way. I'm a very visual person, and from our audiences, when they think about this field, we're so conditioned to think, and people actually will take their left hand when they talk about the field, and they'll say it's out there, and they'll motion away from themselves. They'll say, out there somewhere. If we could think of the universe as a really thick blanket, and our bodies and our lives are fibers within that blanket, and every atom that makes up the cells in our bodies are a part of those fibers, it kind of gives us a sense that we're the fabric. We are the fabric of that blanket. We're the fabric of the universe. John Wheeler actually stated, Albert Einstein's colleague, who's still with us today, there. When I was in school back in the 60s and 70s, I was taught that there, essentially, we are relatively latecomers in the universe, have very little effect. The universe has been here a long time. We've come along recently. We don't have much effect now, and when we're gone, the universe won't ever know we're here, essentially, is what I was taught. And that's a school of thinking. Einstein was of that school. There's another school of thought, and John Wheeler exemplifies this, Einstein's colleague. He says, the universe may have started without us, and it may have been here for a long time, but it's not finished yet. And what he says is that the consciousness and us within consciousness, we are creating the building blocks for the universe, and it's an ever-evolving universe. So essentially what he's saying, if we ever wondered why we can't seem to find the edge of our universe with the Hubble telescope or with our observations, or why we can't seem to find that smallest particle of matter. George, every time we break one open, there's something else there.
Stay with us, Greg. We're going to get to the top of the hour and be back with phone calls.